Wendy Carlisle here with Background Briefing. It's a job creator, a royalty generator, and the lifeblood of an entire city. But Mount Isa Mines, in remote northwest Queensland, is also one of the nation's biggest polluters. For decades, the mine has been releasing into the atmosphere huge amounts of lead, arsenic, and sulphur dioxide, all of which are harmful to the body. Now a handful of families are taking legal action against the mine for the lead poisoning they say their children are suffering. David Lewis has this report.
I've just walked up a hill to join a small crowd of tourists at the Mount Isa lookout in the centre of the city. From here, visitors have a panoramic view of the sprawling suburbs beneath and the dusty red earth that surrounds them, stretching out to the horizon. And what brings you here to Mount Isa?
Oh, the big retirement tour.
Graham and Robin are visiting from Brisbane. They're what you might affectionately call grey nomads. And you've come up here to the lookout here in Mount Isa, where there's one feature in particular that stands out.
Oh, the mines.
The mines.
And, you know, from my earliest age, you know about the Mount Isa mines. So you've got to see it.
And from where we're standing, the sheer size of the mine site is awe-inspiring. And it's right on the doorstep of a city of more than 20,000 people. And what's it like to be here? Is it how you imagined?
It's probably closer. The mine is probably much closer than, even though I've looked online and, you know, done all those sort of homework before we came. I still worry about how close the city is right to the mine. It's there, isn't it? It's imposing.
As you drive into Mount Isa, the mine strangely resembles an ocean liner, like the Titanic, but instead of having fuel chimneys, there's a 270-metre tall lead stack that can be seen from the ground wherever you are in the city, which is handy if you get lost. Next to that is a 155-metre copper stack, dubbed the Candy Stack for its distinctive red and white stripes. And next to that is an acid plant with the shortest of the three stacks. They each pump emissions into an otherwise clear outback sky.
What do you think when you look at what's happening in front of you?
It's, to me, a bit overwhelming. You see all that smoke coming out and, yeah, that's the first question you have to think about.
The poison factor.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in that smoke, are there poisons? You know, the poison in the body, toxic?
The answer to Robin's question is yes. Mount Isa Mines is the nation's biggest polluter of arsenic and sulphur dioxide, and the third biggest polluter of lead, all of which are harmful to the human body. There is no known safe level of lead exposure for children. It lowers their IQ and can cause severe intellectual disabilities. Arsenic causes cancer, and according to the World Health Organization, it's not safe to inhale at any rate. And sulphur dioxide exacerbates asthma and other respiratory conditions, which are common in Mount Isa, especially among Indigenous children.
If it's in the soil in the yard and in the roof and in the parks and wherever, it just gets distributed and redistributed, and it's sort of like toxic snow that never melts.
In the past, the mine had Joe Bielke-Peterson to thank for allowing it to emit lead at three times the national guideline and sulphur dioxide at more than six times the national guideline.
Mount Isa is a long way from anywhere, and they could get away with it. It was a gift to the mining company.
It took 25 years for the Queensland government to introduce tougher pollution controls. Anna Bly gave the mine 5 years to clean up its act. But it was too little, too late for some. Today you'll hear from a mother who claims her daughter has suffered brain damage as a result of the mine's activities.
Oh, Stella has, you know, she has intellectual disabilities where she has to be in special education at school. Stella struggles to understand a lot of things. She's a lot of memory loss. She's not on the same wavelength as children her own age, and she's 15 this year. So Stella finds it very hard to, you know, associate with children her own age because they don't understand her. So,
The mine is fighting the case in court and insists Mount Isa is a safe place for kids.
My family has been here the whole time I've been here. It's my kids that play on the dusty ovals, play rugby on the dusty ovals, ride their horses in the dusty round yards. And they've had really good outcomes in terms of, you know, culture, in terms of sporting and in terms of education.
As the legal battle continues, the state government is still allowing the mine to release three times more arsenic than the Queensland guideline. And although the mine claims its emissions are now consistent with the national guidelines, we can reveal that's not the case on at least one critical measure. I'm David Lewis. This is Background Briefing.
And we'll go down and have a look around.
To begin this story, I'm heading underground. I've come to the Hard Times Mine. It's not a real mine, but a tourist attraction. I still have to wear safety gear, though, beginning with a hard hat, boots, a torch, and some very loud clothing.
All right, so we're kitting up in bright orange overalls.
Yeah, everyone looks good in orange, mate.
The guy making fun of me is Earl Kyle, my tour guide. He'll be leading me into the darkness. If we were at the real mine, we could go almost 2 kilometres beneath the surface of the earth. Today, though, we'll be descending a much less impressive 20 metres.
We open the doors.
So this is the cage.
This is the cage, mate, yes.
Meaning an elevator.
Yep.
Earl presses a button and down we go.
She's noisy. Some pretty unique elevator music you got going there, Earl.
Heavy metal.
Earl Kyle was a production driller at Mount Isa Mines for more than 30 years. And as far as he's concerned, he was good to the mine and the mine was good to him. It provided stable employment, a decent income for his family. He also made lifelong friends along the way. He's very passionate, loves to tell stories, and even plays a few pranks on people.
Mate, no one's seen darkness until they've seen underground, you know? Until they've been underground. And we'll do that now. I'll turn your light off.
Oh, wow.
Oh, your light, that's going to... So you're looking up there, you can't see your hand in front of you.
Oh, that's true. You
you can now.
That is really creepy, actually.
Yeah. What I usually do is I'll try and sneak back a couple of steps and they're looking at me when they turn their lights off and all of a sudden they turn their lights on and I'm not there. Do the disappearing act.
Earl doesn't have a bad word to say about Mount Isa. He can't imagine living anywhere else. When some of his kids left the city to find work, it upset him.
I raised 3 sons, all good sportsmen. Probably, you know, like it's been a great life, eh? And like good pays, and probably the hardest thing in our lives that we've had to endure was when our grandkids left town. You know, we've only got one grandchild left here at the moment. The oldest son, his wife, they moved to Townsville, and he said to me, "Dad, can you go around and pick that old fridge up and chuck it?" And I went back around there, and I tell you, it broke my heart. I walked through the house, and I could smell each one of those kids in their rooms.
Not everyone has fond memories of their time here.
Yeah, we just sort of found it difficult to live there, and then the town as well. A lot of critics...
That's Daphne Hare. She moved to Mount Isa in 2002 to manage a business. Her daughter Stella was 2 years old at the time.
We were probably there for, you know, about 6 months when Stella started to sort of show signs of not being too well. Sort of started with me because I was bleeding from the nose and sore throats. And I'd seen an ENT doctor who said that I had a lot of sulphur in the back of my throat and nose. Stella started developing problems, you know, very lethargic all the time, ear infections, throat infections and chest infections constantly.
Stella was treated with antibiotics until Daphne saw a local newspaper ad warning of the effects of exposing children to lead. That's when she took Stella to get her blood tested.
Her initial test results came back at 11,
That's 11 micrograms per deciliter, 6 points higher than the level at which doctors would express concern and start to case manage the patient. And where did the blood lead levels peak?
They peaked to 17 for her.
Well, alarm bells started ringing.
Oh, you know, it just was a shock, you know, it could have knocked me off the chair. And it wasn't a good feeling at all.
Soon after getting the bad news, Daphne flew to Sydney to meet a toxicologist who did additional tests on Stella.
We had some hair samples actually sent over to Illinois in America, and they were tested and they came back and, yeah, so it was a bit more of a shock to me because not only did she have lead, she had 19 different toxins, including arsenic and cadmium and mercury.
All of those toxins Daphne mentioned there can be found in emissions from Mount Isa mines. When she discovered this, she and Stella fled the city. They now live in Charters Towers near Townsville. But Daphne says the damage has been done.
Oh, Stella has, you know, she has intellectual disabilities where she has to be in special education at school. Stella struggles to understand a lot of things. She's a lot of memory loss. She's not on the same wavelength as children her own age, and she's 15 this year. So Stella finds it very hard to, you know, associate with children her own age because they don't understand her. So it's a bit of a bleak future for her in the sense of, you know, for her be able to survive and live independently.
Daphne was among the first to go public with her concerns about lead poisoning. As it turned out, Stella's was not an isolated case. A survey by Queensland Health found 11% of children in Mount Isa had worrying amounts of lead in their blood. Dr. Stephen Donoghue is the Director of Public Health in North Queensland.
We know that there's a whole spectrum of effects that are possible from lead, all the way from no visible effects to hypertension, minor problems with the kidneys, abdominal pains, all the way to neuropsychiatric problems, coma and death.
Dr. Donoghue describes it as an invisible problem, adding that in the majority of cases, the symptoms are hard to detect, like loss of IQ, for example.
Once you get below levels where you can see obvious symptoms such as neurological problems or kidney problems or hearing problems or blood pressure problems, if you look at population surveys of how well children do in school or how well they reach their milestones for development as a child or formal IQ testing, you can still show a relationship to lead exposure around those types of levels, even in children who don't have any obvious symptoms. In other words, that large number of children exposed to lead at those levels will have a slightly lower average IQ than if they had not been exposed to lead.
As you can imagine, the Children's Health Survey caused quite a stir. There was heated debate. Where did all the lead come from? Was it the mine? Or was it naturally occurring in the soil? It turns out the mine had already launched an investigation called the Lead Pathways Study. It quickly produced two reports looking at the impact of its operations on waterways and soil and took some remedial action. But the long-awaited final report into air quality has been delayed by 5 years.
They've delayed the most critical component of that Lead Pathways Study.
Professor Mark Taylor is an environmental scientist at Sydney's Macquarie University. He thinks the mine is hiding something.
They probably don't want to produce that information.
Because the information shows what?
Well, I suspect the information isn't favourable to them. Otherwise, why wouldn't you just publish it? Why don't you make all your environmental data that you collect at all of your sites publicly available?
Background Briefing tried to get a copy of the unpublished report under Freedom of Information laws, but was denied on the grounds of commercial in confidence. But Glencore's Mike Westerman now says the document is caught up in academic review.
So the air quality report is tied up at the moment in a discussion between the author of that report and a peer reviewer. Now, that report is slightly different from the other two reports that we've had issued. It's a lot more complex, it's a lot more detailed, and I think, look, the discussion there at the moment is around research methodologies, recreating some of that data. So we certainly need an agreement between a couple of academics before we get that report released.
According to Professor Mark Taylor, this explanation doesn't add up.
It seems incomprehensible to me that a study like that would take so long.
I decided to seek a second opinion from Professor Kerry Carrington. She's the head of the Justice School at the Queensland University of Technology, or QUT, in Brisbane.
How long typically does a research paper take to be peer-reviewed? What's the time frame?
Well, in the online era, 6 weeks is kind of what most really good journals would look for. If you have some hiccups in the process, like you might get a reviewer that disagrees and you might have to send it out for re-review or something, you know, worst case scenario, 6 months.
Worst case scenario, 6 months.
Yes.
Glencore insists it's not attempting to bury any bad news. Mike Westerman again.
If I had to have a look at what would come out of that report, I would suggest it would be similar to what came out in the land report, which is, yes, there are emissions from this mine. Some of them do end up in the community and they're low impact or low risk to human health.
Have you seen the draft report?
No, I have not seen the draft report.
Okay. So you don't know what picture it paints of the air quality here in Mount Isa and the mine's role?
Oh, look, I have a good enough understanding of air quality in Mount Isa here, obviously.
All three of the reports that make up the Lead Pathways study were produced by the Sustainable Minerals Institute. Although it's attached to the University of Queensland, it receives the bulk of its funding from the mining industry. According to Professor Kerry Carrington, who studied the relationship between the resources sector and universities, this kind of arrangement has the potential to interfere with the integrity of the academic process.
That means that research is not independent. They may lack transparency. Results, if they're not favourable to the corporation, may be silenced, undermined, never seen. They may just be buried. There is no necessary impost on those reports to become public. And in other cases, we know that researchers who have gone into contracts with corporate giants, particularly in the mining sector, have in fact forfeited their intellectual property and their moral rights. And in those instances, they really have no say over what happens to their end product, whether it ever sees the light of day or not.
Glencore doesn't know when the critical air quality report will be released, but Mike Westerman says he's as unhappy about the delay as anyone else.
Again, we would like this report out. We would like to demonstrate confidence in the community that we act on the recommendations as we've done with the previous two reports. The fact that we can't do that doesn't sit well with us.
The report could contain important information for those who claim lead emissions from the mine have poisoned their kids. In 2008, lawyer Damien Scatini, formerly of Slater and Gordon, launched a compensation claim on behalf of parents like Daphne Hare. Why do you think emissions from the mine are to blame?
The science is clear on this. The stuff that is in the children, that gets into the children, it's in the backyards and in the roofs and in the filters of the air conditioning and on the dog, has been through the furnace. So it's an utter furphy to say that it's naturally occurring. You know, I've seen all the arguments. You know, we built the mine there because that's where the lead is. I get that, but you've got to dig it up first, and that's what's happened. And that's just a disingenuous argument. It's against the science, and shame on them for putting that out.
So the science shows that the lead that's being detected in the backyards of many houses in Mount Isa has been through the smelting process. Is that what you're saying?
It's been cooked, yeah.
The science Damien Scatini is talking about was carried out by Professor Mark Taylor. He collected soil samples across Mount Isa at various depths, starting on the surface, then a little deeper, and so on.
There was two things there that came out of that study. We could see an increase in the surface soil concentrations of a range of metals as you got closer to the mine, and you could also see a significant increase in the surface soil metals in the very top part of the soil. And as you go down in that soil profile, down to about half a metre, you see a really rapid fall off in concentrations.
In other words, the amount of lead in the soil decreases the deeper you dig, which would seem to support the argument the lead is falling from the sky, since most of it is found in the topsoil.
And those depositions would accumulate in dust particles in your house, on your house, in your garden, on your garden toys, on your plants, etc. And because they're elemental, they don't go away. So they would accumulate month after month.
What's the lifespan of lead deposition, for example?
There's nobody really knows what the half-life of lead is exactly in terms of environmental impact, but there have been some studies, and one of them suggested the half-life was about 700 years.
Right. So the lead's not going anywhere fast.
No.
Or, as Damien Scatini puts it,
it just gets distributed and redistributed, and it's sort of like toxic snow that never melts.
In a statement, Glencore told Background Briefing it will defend the case and those of two other families. The case will rest on whether the mine failed to warn about the risks of lead exposure. It's an accusation that would be difficult to make today. Mount Isa Mines has ramped up its involvement in public health campaigns. Together with the state government, it jointly funds the Living with Lead Alliance. As the name suggests, the organisation teaches residents how to protect themselves from lead exposure. This television commercial emphasises personal hygiene.
Wash children's hands regularly. The amount of lead contamination on a child's hands has been directly related to blood lead levels. For information, call 1800 457 547. Authorised by the Living with Lead Alliance, Mount Isa.
From an outsider's perspective, the name Living with Lead Alliance can seem like a bit of an oxymoron. Is it actually possible to safely live with lead?
Well, I'd say absolutely.
Rob Catter is the chair of the Living with Lead Alliance. Representing the Catter Party, he's also the MP for Mount Isa.
You know, it's not a run for the hill situation. Yeah. It's something you have to manage. We've acknowledged that. And we've proven that you can safely live with it without too much effort, really, or too much impact on your lifestyle.
Rob says a follow-up Queensland Health survey found the number of children with concerning blood lead levels had roughly halved. He attributes this result, at least in part, to the work of the Alliance, which had been running educational workshops in schools, featuring a mascot named Squeaky the Mouse.
The longer you're around with Squeaky the Mouse, our mascot, and our...
Larry Lead?
No, that's one of the failed marketing programs we had.
What happened to Larry Lead?
Actually, I've got to tell you, I didn't even heard of Larry Lead. I probably wouldn't have backed that one as a as a promotional tool. Squeaky the Mouse has been doing a great job at shows and the, you know...
Okay, so we won't talk about Larry Lead. But the Living with Lead Alliance is keen to discuss another initiative, one that encourages residents to renovate their backyards to make them safer for children. For mother of two, Sky Taylor, that required making some dramatic changes.
What did the backyard look like before all of this?
It had, I think, three massive trees, some pavers, a gazebo, no fences. It's a bit overgrown.
All of that greenery has since made way for imitation grass and concrete.
Walk us through some of the changes here. I'm looking at some fake turf.
Yeah, so we've took all the trees out, the pavers out. We've put some colourbond fence and some pool fences up. We've got some crusher dust underneath and laid the fake grass down. And then we've got some cement area on the side, and then there's all our play equipment on top.
So what was it you were worried about in terms of raising a child here in Mount Isa?
I've brought them bred here. But, yeah, just the lead. I know it's not a big deal, but just when you've got your first-time mum, I'm going to try and make the best for them.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
And so when you say it's no big deal, you felt pretty comfortable given you'd grown up here yourself?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, not a problem.
So what have the lead level checks been like for your kids?
Yeah, they've been fine. Been perfect, so that's good.
And what about your neighbours and your friends? Have other parents seen what you've done?
Yeah, they love the idea. Some of them wanted to do it themselves and like the idea of the fake grass, which is good.
So somebody somewhere in Mount Isa is making a killing out of fake grass sales?
Yes.
Lawyer Damien Scatini is uncomfortable with the work of the Living with Lead Alliance. He thinks the focus on personal hygiene places too much responsibility on parents and not enough on the mine.
We put all the onus on the mothers. And if your child has an elevated blood lead level, then that must be due to poor mothering. And it is mothering. That's kind of where the focus was, because dad's expected to be working in the mine, I suppose. But you put the onus on the mother to make sure that the child doesn't go outside. What sort of life is that? Make sure the child doesn't pat the dog. Make sure the child isn't exposed to, doesn't put their fingers in their mouth. And say, well, if a child does any of that, then it's the mother's fault for, you know, for what the consequences of that are, without saying, well, perhaps it's something to do with the gross deposition of lead into the environment in which that child lives.
Professor Mark Taylor agrees.
If you live in an environment which is subject to a constant rain or deposition of contaminants, such that you'd have to clean your home several times a day in order to keep the dust levels below the specified standard, nobody can do that. You just can't maintain it. It's impossible. Again, if you stopped emitting it at the source, problem goes away.
Except in the case of Mount Isa, we're talking about the only employer in town which keeps people in work and also contributes $1 billion each year to the Queensland economy. So the option of shutting it down is not a realistic one.
Well, it's not really a matter of shutting it down. It's a matter of employing maximum best practice and doing that over a sustained period and cleaning up in town, capturing all emissions and protecting the people before they get contaminated. It's not a matter of you can't have that business. We've never said that. That's not what it's about. What we've always said is the environmental controls and the levels permissible into the environment are not adequate.
I mentioned earlier that until recently, a special agreement with the Queensland government meant that Mount Isa Mines was allowed to emit 3 times more lead and 6 times more sulphur dioxide than the national guidelines recommend. In 2011, the mine was given 5 years to meet tougher environmental conditions. And now, Glencore's Mike Westerman says it's meeting them.
We are at that stage where all of our measures are consistent with the National Environmental Protection measures, and we currently meet those.
It is true that the mine now meets the national guideline for lead emissions. It has for a couple of years. But it's incorrect to suggest the mine meets the national guideline for hourly sulphur dioxide emissions. Professor Mark Taylor again.
It's just simply factually incorrect that the mine meets the national standard. It does not.
I'll explain why in a moment, but first, I've come to Mount Isa Mines to see for myself how Glencore has been able to reduce emissions to the extent the company can make those claims about meeting the national guidelines.
So where are we heading now?
Okay, so we're heading up to the AQC Control Centre.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the Air Quality Control Centre. It's perched on a ridge overlooking the city.
Now, is this the best view in Mount Isa?
It is probably the best view in Mount Isa, yes, because it's looking the right way. but it's an important view because, I mean, that's where we live.
The Air Quality Control Centre is essentially a weather station full of forecasting equipment. The team here is trying to predict changes in wind direction that could push toxic plumes from the mine into the suburbs where people live.
So we're on the mine side, mm-hmm. and we're facing the town on the east?
Yes, that's quite correct.
Matthew Meir is showing me around. His job title is Superintendent of Air Quality and Technical Instruments. Essentially, he's the guy who decides when the lead and copper smelters should scale back production or even shut down altogether to avoid impacting the city.
The positioning is quite critical for what we do up here, because you can have all the instrumentation in the world, but ultimately we have guys up here who make decisions.
Yep.
And the best information that you can sometimes get is looking out the window and seeing what's going on.
Wind direction is key. Easterly winds are good as they push emissions away from residents. Westerly winds are not so good.
Why is that?
Simply because the town lies on the westerly, kind of downwind of the operations when the westerly wind is blowing.
So if the winds changed mm-hmm. and emissions started blowing over the city right now, mm-hmm. would you have to stop or cease production or reduce yeah. production?
Yes, the controllers would assess what the conditions were like, right. what the risk was of seeing elevations, and would... First up, would put the operations onto what they call an orange status, and being an orange status like traffic lights, it'll be get ready to slow down.
Okay.
Something's going to happen.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean that something will happen. It just means that, you've got to be prepared. Then, if things were evolving, then they'd be having a look at, well, what can we actually sustain, or do we need to actually cease emissions altogether?
It sounds simple enough, but shutting down a busy copper smelter or lead smelter can't be done with the push of a button. It takes a little while.
So what would the lag time be? Can you give us a ballpark figure of how many minutes that might take from the moment you take a decision to the moment production is reduced?
Yes, so you can potentially get a turnaround in about 15 minutes to do it safely.
As Matthew and I are talking, the weather conditions start to change for the worse.
So what's happening at the moment?
Oh, OK. At the moment, we've already taken some preemptive action to mitigate risk in town. So we've seen that the smelters have actually been put on restrictive status at the moment.
OK. So what happens now? You just watch and wait?
Yes, we watch and wait. So we're already set up to see how it will go. We'll then monitor it if there is an impact. And if there is an excessive impact, then we will start winding things back further.
The problem for the mine is that westerly winds are common in Mount Isa, especially during summer. But that doesn't mean the mine always winds down when westerlies are blowing. It makes an exception if there's a cold air inversion happening. An inversion is supposed to work like this. If there's a band of cold air on the surface, the warmer air above it will carry the emissions over the city without any of the heavy metals falling onto residents.
There are conditions that you'd see in, you know, especially in our outback climate, where you get a fairly solid inversion happening. And when that happens, the warm plumes can't actually descend to the surface of the planet, simply because they're so much warmer than the cold air that sits on the ground. So when that happens, yes, you can see our plumes actually scooting over town, but they're not going to touch the ground. So
the emissions will simply blow over the top of the community.
It'll skip over the top and keep going, yeah, until it's fully dispersed.
After my visit, I put this to Professor Mark Taylor, the environmental scientist. But this cold air inversion idea stacks up, right? It is true that if there is a cold air inversion, the emissions blowing over the city won't immediately land on the houses, right?
The data doesn't show that. The data shows, with lead in air samplers in the city, that you get spikes in the summer. Now, why would you get spikes in the summer? Where's the lead coming from? There's only two sources. There's three. There's the mine itself, the copper stack and the lead stack. So it's basically the mine. So if their air inversion theory works, and it may have some credibility, but the problem is the data doesn't really support it as being completely effective, because if it was completely effective, you would not see spikes of lead in air in the summer period when the wind blows from the west.
But you do see those spikes, and the National Guideline for Hourly Sulphur Dioxide Emissions allows for breaches to occur on just one day each year. But the Environment Department's air monitors show the mine has already breached that limit several days this year.
The data's validated, and it shows in January of 2016, there were at least four times when the SO2 one-hour value was exceeded.
So the mine doesn't meet that national guideline after all. But here's the catch. It doesn't have to. The state government generously allows the mine to breach the national guideline. These breaches can exacerbate respiratory conditions like asthma. And we know from a recent study that Indigenous children in Mount Isa have some of the highest rates of respiratory illnesses in the world.
Well, it increases their risk of suffering from things like asthma, wheeze, shortness of breath, and clearly increases the rate of potential hospital separations, i.e. having to spend the night in the hospital because they're suffering from some respiratory illness. And also, of course, there's a long-term damage of breathing in sulphur dioxide, which would probably form sulfuric acid in your lungs. And anybody who knows anything would know that sulfuric acid on your tissue is not such a good thing. It's quite aggressive.
You'd think all this talk of lead poisoning and respiratory problems would be enough to trigger a mass exodus of families from Mount Isa. But that hasn't happened. Many people here either don't believe it or choose to ignore it.
You read or you hear in the media that there is something wrong with the brains of kids who were born in Mount Isa. I take objection to that. First of all, as a father and a person who's had access to all sorts of information, there wouldn't be too many people in this city or in this state that would have more information about Mad Eyes and Minds than me. Now, do you honestly believe that I would stay living in this city if it had adverse health effects on my wife or my two kids? Nowhere in the world would I. And the vast majority of people in this city have the same view as myself.
Tony McGrady came to Mount Isa from the UK in the 1970s to work in the mine. He later became the state minister for mines and twice served as mayor of the city. He's fed up with all this negative press.
If the environment here wasn't safe, don't you honestly believe there would be hundreds of people lining up at a hospital or a private doctor's complaining about the conditions which they're working under? It doesn't happen. Don't you think the trade union movement would have something to say or take industrial action if the conditions weren't what they should be?
I put this to Professor Mark Taylor. Tony McGrady said to me, if the mine was really doing so much damage to the environment and to the health of children and workers, then unions would be on strike, there'd be a traffic jam on the Barclay Highway as families flee the city, yet none of that is happening. He has a point, doesn't he?
Well, the effects of exposure are subtle, they're subclinical. You know, we don't see people falling over in the playground from subclinical exposures to lead. The effects are losses of IQ, maybe increased asthma levels, and we know that asthma's increasing in the population more generally, but it's increasing at a greater rate in Mount Isa. So these are difficult things to tease out without complex studies. There's never been a complex health study at Mount Isa. But what we do know is that all of the data that we've looked at suggests all of the same things, that these children will be suffering adversely from these effects. But people aren't dying in the streets, but these are decrements of people's life and their opportunities through the loss of IQ points. And of course, it's unlikely that people will be throwing their arms up and saying, this is appalling, this is terrible, because this is a close community. We see the same thing in Port Pirie and Broken Hill. You know, people don't want to bag the community if they live in there.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Tim Roxburgh. Technical production this week by Lila Schunner. The executive producer is Wendy Carlisle. I'm David Lewis.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Fran Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.